Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming this afternoon. We have some exciting TED Talks to do, which is a new experience for us, so we're pretty excited about that. First, we're going to hear from Jay Flynn. He's a director of adult recovery services with Mental Health Center of Denver, and he oversees all the adult services, and he's going to talk about the 21st century of integrated care team.
I am on mic. What do you know? It's there. Well, I'm really excited to be here and talk about our 21st Century Integrated Care Grant. This is a grant that we were able to put together with Denver Health and Mental Health Center of Denver, and it really allows us to provide integrated care treatment for folks who have really serious mental illnesses and very, very complicated medical pictures. So when we looked at doing this grant, what we looked at was the folks that we were treating at Mental Health Center of Denver. And we were seeing the same folks at Denver Health, but not just in the psychiatric unit. We're seeing them in the medical unit. We're seeing them in the ED. And they're not only there for psychiatric reasons, they're there for medical reasons. And it's the same, it's sort of that phenomenon of the same faces in different places. And they weren't having good medical outcomes. You know, years ago we had this sort of idea that we were doing really well if we could attach somebody to a primary care physician. And that was super. And then we just figured they'd get everything they need. And magically that doesn't happen. And we're going to talk a little bit about why that magically doesn't just happen. Because some of our folks that we serve and love have some significant challenges. So we saw the few people that we serve dying 25 years young. I've been with the Mental Health Center for 27 years. So I see people that know I was a very young man, that I knew who were young, very young people. And they're 50, and they're dying of enormously preventable diseases. And then you ask what this is about. And it's pretty clear. It's sort of not rocket science. People familiar with the ACE study, the adverse childhood experience? You know, so our folks have trauma. We look at the folks that we serve coming into our high-intensity treatment teams, and more than 90% of those folks have had very significant trauma. You cannot live on the streets of Denver without being raped, robbed, and brutalized. You can't have a mental illness and survive out there without significant trauma. And when we look at ACE scores, it's not surprising we get these medical outcomes. When we look at follow-up to medical care, it's not surprising. When we look at everything it takes to get good medical care, how can it be surprising? I'd like you to take a minute and think about your own life and think about a medical challenge you might have had. There might be somebody here that's not had a medical challenge, but I bet there's very few people that haven't. And think about that medical challenge that you faced. And think of everything it took you to get through that and to get through that successfully. How did you advocate for yourself? When you got a prescription, how did you get it filled? How did you make sure that you followed through with all of the doctor's recommendations that were going to keep you alive? And the folks that we're talking about with serious mental illness, homelessness, serious trauma histories, these are people I knew 25 years ago, and it might not have been one thing that's killing them today. Overeating, sedentary lifestyle, not taking medications, not abiding by routines for a lot of chronic medical issues like heart disease and diabetes. Think of when you have to go back and follow a medication regime. You know, you go and you get that filled, and then you go home, and then you set a timer on your bedside, and you know that you're going to get up when that rings and get your medications or something like that. Well, a lot of our consumers, their bedside is in an alley. It's in a cardboard box. They don't have an alarm clock. They're not real good at getting places exactly on time, taking meds exactly on time, and following pretty complicated orders. So we put this grant together to really look at some of the folks who had the highest needs. And we really did look for the folks who had the highest needs in mental health, folks who were homeless, folks who were on the street, folks who had criminal justice involvement, folks who were court-ordered treatment sometimes in some cases. And we looked at folks who had the most complicated medical pictures. And Denver Health is great about that. They know those folks. You know, we get together and we know all the same people. We put the grant in, and we came up with two big components that apply to MHCD, and that's the pieces that I'm here to talk about. One of that those components is our assertive community treatment team. So we took the concept of assertive community treatment, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, the concept that we're going to have a team of case managers that go out in the community, link consumers to natural resources in the community, advocate for consumers, put them in the car, and absolutely get things done. You know, assertive community treatment is a real get it done attitude. And then we also have outplaced licensed clinical social workers. So we have five LCSWs that we hire. And we place them out in Denver Health Clinics because we know we see our consumers. We say our consumers. I don't even think that makes any sense anymore. Denver Health consumers, MHED consumers. And they see folks out there. They're doing problem-solving, solution-based treatment. And they're catching folks out there. And they're intervening. And we're helping people live longer lives. But not just longer lives. Really, it's better lives. It's how do we intervene and help people have better lives. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the assertive community treatment team. What we were able to do, again, is 100 people, 100 consumers every day. Somebody graduates, we replace that person with somebody new. Folks come in the team from Denver Health. We have 6 case managers with bachelor's degrees. We have 2 case managers with master's level degrees and licensed. So we're able to do lots of case management and lots of therapy, and it's really all about evidence-based practices. When we looked at what we wanted to do, we wanted to make sure it worked. Assertive community treatment, of course, is an evidence-based practice in and of itself. We looked at certainly being a trauma-informed treatment team, and we used the TREM model. There's lots of great models, a number of great models out there. We used the Trauma Recovery Empowerment Model out of Washington, and we used motivational interviewing, which I'm sure a lot of you are really familiar with. Motivational interviewing is one of those best practices that really fits our philosophy. Like you, I'm sure, we have a recovery philosophy. You know, recovery is about people getting their life back. Recovery is about getting a life worth living back and having it in a self-directed fashion. Motivational interviewing is a really good way to do that. It helps people find their own motivation for why they want to overcome their ambivalence. Helps us avoid arguments. It helps us roll with resistance. We've actually banned the word resistance, not only at the 21st Century team, but all of MHCD. We don't talk about resistance anymore, actually. We talk about ambivalence. Talked about that issue that I asked you to think about, that medical thing that you overcame. Did you have any resistance, or did you have resistance about getting better? You know what resistance is? Resistance is, you had resistance if you didn't do what I tell you to do, and you were resisting me. You might have had some ambivalence. Somebody give you pills with really difficult side effects? And we have great pills. We have great technology. But they do sometimes come with side effects. You have every right and every reason to look at those side effects and make a good decision. And you might have ambivalence. Our consumers have some of the same ambivalence. So we've changed that and turned it on our head. Using motivational interviewing, it has been great for that. Now you can imagine that this has taken a lot of training. And training has been a core part of what we had to do for 21st Century. We've done an enormous amount of training for the staff in motivational interviewing, in assertive community treatment, and in care management. We happen to pick the University of Massachusetts care model, and we've used that model, and we've trained all of those staff. We've actually trained all of our case managers in that model and certified them in that model. So they're care managers. And they understand that in addition to a case manager, they're a care manager, and they manage that care. And it's an interesting twist to what we do. We're real used to taking best practices in mental health and using those best practices to get great recovery outcomes, to get great mental health outcomes, to help people reach their mental health goals. Well, what we've done with 21st Century is taking mental health technology, best practices, we're really very consciously applying them to behaviors that get better medical outcomes. Because there's lots of behaviors. Some of those behaviors I talked about, it's complying with your diabetic diet. It's going to the dentist. It's accessing treatment. It's changing your sedentary lifestyle. It's taking medications that will enhance your life and prolong your life. It's making that happen. Think about all the medical technology we have. For a second. Enormous amount of medical technology at our hands. If somebody doesn't use it, you might as well live in the Stone Age. I mean, seriously, we can take somebody's appendix out really easy, yes? So if you're living in an alley in a cardboard box and your appendix bursts and it never gets out, you might as well have been living in the Middle Ages. And that's where a lot of our consumers live. It's a whole different time warp. If we want to have consumers have great lives and have great health outcomes, it's a matter of applying our science, our mental health science, to changing behaviors that have to do with health outcomes. Now, the other side of that coin, of course, is the health providers, the primary health care providers. One of the big things when we looked at 21st century, we knew we had to implement, was co-location. I talked about co-locating our five LCSWs out in the Denver Health Clinics. That's great. And those are huge clinics. Those people are flying through there, thousands of people a day. So we also co-located primary care providers at the mental health center. So at our recovery center, same building, same floor, same area that our 21st century care team works, we have an entire wing dedicated to primary care. And it just makes such an enormous difference. And I know a lot of you folks do it. And if you can do it a lot, you can do a lot of it, it's really helpful. For me to take somebody and take Joe and just bring him across the hallway and introduce him to Sally, the primary care provider, she can sit down and have a great 5-minute conversation with him. That warm handoff means he's going to come back tomorrow. That warm handoff means that he's going to listen to her thoughts. Now, the other bright side is she's going to do a really thorough eval on him. She's liable to prescribe medications. She's liable to refer him to a specialist. Now, we don't have the specialist in the building, but that's back to our case management team or our care management team. So we have the ability to make sure folks are going to get to their specialists. They're going to get back to Sally. They're going to get back out to their care manager. They're going to wade through all that Byzantine process of getting treatment. And it takes an enormous amount to get that treatment. It's convoluted. There's insurance issues. Having somebody by your side to do that and to advocate that you get the right care is paramount to getting good results. So by doing this, by working with Denver Health, by co-locating everybody, by using evidence-based practices to change behavior that gets better outcomes, we have better outcomes. We looked at that. One of the things we didn't want to do is not have a couple of outcomes. So even in the short existence of the team, so far we've seen a 40% decrease in homelessness. I mean, you can imagine that. The team really is about health. But in that process, we got a 40% decrease in homelessness. And you can almost do the math. I told you we had a 100-person team, right? So there's a lot of homeless people. I mean, we have less than 2% of our folks that are homeless at any time, and they have a place to live that night. So we have everybody housed. We got a lot of homeless people on that team. We got them housed. Now, that makes it so much easier to comply with your medical treatment. You know, have a place to live, you can have that alarm clock, you can have a place that your case manager can pick you up. You know, you start getting hope. One of the things that we also trained our staff in was the concept of hope. We do a whole training on hope. And it's not just having hope. We measure staff hope, we measure client hope, and then we measured our outcomes. What we found is that staff that had hope, clients that had hope, and staff that had been trained in hope, their clients had better outcomes than everybody else because they had hope. The genesis of hope is a couple of victories, as most of you probably know. Helping people be self-efficacious. You know, everybody here, you're wildly successful people. You might not completely get that. Think of everything you had to do to be sitting in this room today. It's phenomenal, the things you had to do to be here today. A lot of our consumers have not recently experienced that. So we help them experience the concept of I'm going to try to do something and it's going to work. And the idea here is I'm going to go to the doctor because maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's worth having good health. Maybe it's worth living. We have a saying at the Mental Health Center, and I probably have a saying because I say it a lot, but dead people don't recover. You got to keep people alive so they can recover, so they can get their recovery. And people do recover, but it's so important that they don't die at 50 and aren't able to live the rest of their life. The other result we've got is we've gotten a 37% reduction in medical bed days, hospital days. 37%, which is an enormous reduction in bed days on a very, very, very expensive outlay for treatment. It's the most expensive thing we can do for somebody is when they're in the hospital, especially for medical. Conversely and interestingly, we've also gotten a 77% reduction in psychiatric days. So it's really cyclical. It goes in a cycle. You help people with their medical condition and their psychiatric needs go down. You help somebody with their psychiatric needs and they start getting their medical needs resolved and they're not in the hospital all the time. And the folks, I don't even have to tell this group, your folks don't like being in the hospital. They don't enjoy that. At least the vast majority of your folks don't like being in the hospital. So we can help people be out of the hospital and live that life that they can actually love. So integrating care, using our best science in mental health to change behaviors that are very specifically tied to health outcomes, and co-location of staff is key to getting those results. It's been a really fascinating and fun ride for us to do that. The outcomes are really for our clients. And it's not my outcomes, because it's what our clients want. It's what they're telling us they want. It's not that. It's a self-directed process of transformation for our consumers. It's that self-directed process of having a life worth living and living long enough to experience it. Thank you. I've been told to ask you for questions. Don't. It's easy if you don't have questions, but I'll give you one more chance. Okay. Where are the resources? That's a great question. And it's an interesting answer for the 21st century health team. For many of our teams, we do a housing first model. This team doesn't have the funding tied to it to do that. So we look at that on a day-by-day basis. Where are you living now, and where are you going to stay tonight? We're lucky enough to have 16 group homes and 5 of our own apartment buildings. So one of the things we often do, we'll transition somebody through one of our group homes for a week or for 3 months, and from there we transition them into independent housing mostly. The vast majority of our clients want to live by themselves. It's sort of interesting. You ask people where they want to live by themselves. You ask their family, they'd like them to live in a group home. But most of our consumers want to, say, their short period of time, move into their own apartment. So we're looking at all kinds of vouchers, Section 8, HUD 202, Shelter Plus Care. Most people want to get into their own apartment. Well over 70% of our consumers and the team live in their own apartments. Clearly, some folks will end up living in assisted living because that's where they are in their life. Some folks at some point may be in nursing homes, but that's not who we're treating right now. Other questions? Yeah, it's very limited for us, but we're fortunate enough to have our housing department. We manage over 600 housing vouchers at any given moment. We were able to just open that housing list for vouchers Friday. Before I came up here, I helped out in the morning before driving out because we didn't know how many thousands of people we might have show up to get on the list for Section 8. We do a really good job. One of the things having been working in this field for 27 years is helpful to me is to know the long view. You put in an application 10 years ago and it pays off 3 years later. We put in 2,500 or so applications in on Friday and got 2,500 new people on the list. That won't happen tomorrow, but that'll pay off in time. The work we did 3 years ago is paying off today, so we have a reasonable number of vouchers. We have quite a number of vouchers for our consumers. Other questions? Well, great. Thank you so much. It's been nice being here, and have a great conference.
I have to wait and give them the mic back.
Thank you, Jay. That was great. Our next speaker is Alan Gerard. He's the Director of Effectiveness and Practice Management. He has been at Jefferson Center for the last 12 years, and he oversees the bilingual Spanish program, which he's going to speak about today. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming. Wow, that's loud. My name is Alan Gerard. I'm the Director of Effectiveness and Practice Management, and it's a privilege to talk to you today about one of our exciting programs, Centro Don Este Nuestra Comunidad. It's also an honor to do so during Hispanic Heritage Month. I move around a lot, so if I'm blocking the pictures that'll be up there, just tell me to move myself out of the way, and I will. So if I can start, if everyone will please raise your hand in the air like this. All right, now pick your favorite finger and keep that one up and close and make a fist with the rest. All right, looking around the room, getting a little bit of everything. So some of you have your thumbs up like this. You're telling me I'm doing a good job, so thank you very much. A lot of you are pointing either to the ceiling or maybe you're thinking, you know, we're number one. We're number one. Some of you, I guess, have already completed your evaluation because you had the next finger up. Shame on you. Some of you are up for a challenge because you're raising your ring finger and you're realizing how uncomfortable that actually is. And then the rest of you, a few of you have your pinky fingers up. I don't know, maybe that's a quick shout out to Austin Powers, right? Dr. Evil. All right, so that favorite finger represents the 1 in 5. You can go ahead and put your hands down, sorry. Bill, it's 18 minutes, keep it up. 1 in 5 Americans has a diagnosable mental health disorder. And that's the reason that we're all gathered here this weekend in beautiful Breckenridge. Of that 1 in 5, 40% will receive treatment services. But fair warning, the numbers are going to get more sobering. But there is a good brewery down the street if you need for after we're done. Less than 10% of Hispanics receive treatment services. That means that our Hispanic community is 4 times less likely to receive services. Whoops. The actual number is 1 in less than 11, but my bad at math brain has a really hard time conceptualizing that. So let's make it a little easier. Let's go with 1 in 10. Okay, 1 in 10, that's the same number of people who are left-handed or that live on an island. Who wouldn't want to live on an island and have that as your neighbor? I know I'm in. What about this gentleman? I don't think he wants to live on that island anymore. He looks awfully alone and afraid. There's doom and gloom all around. At the same time, there's some hope, because he represents that 1 in less than 11 Hispanic individuals that's asking for help. It's unlikely, though, that he's going to get in connection with us as behavioral health providers, community health centers, because he's more likely to get support from his extended family, his community, his traditional healers, and or his churches. Within the community that we serve at Jefferson Center, 1 in 5 residents is Hispanic. That's the fastest growing minority population, both locally and nationally. And at Jefferson Center, we want to be a provider of choice for our Hispanic and Spanish-speaking communities. So as part of that process, we received an equity and health grant that allowed us to focus more on our cultural competency and diversity efforts. And through that, we realized that we wanted to be a part of helping to alleviate that behavioral health disparity that exists. So then we asked ourselves, well, you know, are we a provider of choice? That's kind of an interesting question. So one way we wanted to kind of figure that out, we had one of our Spanish-speaking clinicians call into the center in Spanish to see what would happen. The goal was to get transferred to her own voicemail. So how did we do? We had a bad connection. We were successful only about a third of the time, which means that 2/3, most of the time, right, we either hung up on her or we transferred her around and around. Kind of like calling your local cable company, if anyone's had that pleasure. All right, so that's not good. So that brings me to Centro Don Este. At Centro Don Este, Nuestra Comunidad, I'm getting a thumbs up, keep them up. Thumbs up, all right. At Centro Don Este, we do things differently. We want to bring together our Hispanic community and then what we excel at, which is behavioral health services. So we created a program that would present itself as another option and opportunity for our Hispanic community. We wanted to make sure that we didn't segregate this community by saying, well, okay, you have to go to Centro Don Este. You can't go to another office at Jefferson Center, because that's not true. We have bilingual resources throughout the center at multiple sites of ours. But we wanted to have another option. It's always nice to have a choice in life, right? So at Central Donuts, we do things a little bit differently. We opened our doors in late 2012, and we're about four things. First, meeting our community at places that are within the community. Number two, raising awareness through prevention and education classes that anybody in the community can attend. Number three, real-time access to and provision of behavioral health services. And finally, number four, creating community partnerships and being an essential part of that community. So we're going to talk about some more in-depth about those four things. Number one, being a part of the community. This is where we're located. This is a local middle school in Lakewood. So there's the front door of the school, and then off to the right-hand side there, we have our own private entrance for Central Donuts. We've got signage in the parking lot so you know how to get there. And then right as you get to the door, we've got the sign so that you know you're in the right place. The picture at the top left there is our ribbon-cutting ceremony. So we had several members of the community come join us and celebrate the opening of Central Donuts. 84% of all the services that we provide are provided in community locations, so not our center offices. A lot of times we're the host at O'Connell Middle School for our community. So these are pictures of our annual Dia del Niño event. And this is our team. From left to right, we have Esmeralda Santiano, we have Nicole Linhart, and Jennifer Bergen. Not pictured are the interns that have helped create Central Donuts, Jay Heater, Dulce Garcia, and Allison. Not pictured also is Peter Erdialis, and he, we'll get to meet him in a few minutes. So the team and the community that we work with will help me continue the story of Central Donuts. Which brings me to important thing number two, going out into the community and providing behavioral health services and prevention services. So in order, and this is what Essie on the left there does. It's a big part of what she does. And in order to do that right, you have to not only be a part of, but you also have to understand your community. And you have to have something to offer your community. And what that usually looks like is that we'll go out to one of our community partners and we'll provide a service with their folks at their place. One example is Bozy Cortisone, which one of our partners, Mental Health Center of Denver, developed and lets us use. So this is the story of Gary, who was an adolescent who started going to Bozy Cortisone, which, by the way, is an adolescent suicide prevention program. So he started going because a friend told him about it. He wasn't quite sure, you know, what to expect. So he started going, and from the first time he went, he knew that it was the right fit for him. He was able to connect with people. He was more outgoing. And he continued going and going, and he always looks forward to it. And I asked him, I said, you know, there's an awful lot of stigma that goes with mental health. What do you think about that? And he said, oh, I've never thought about it as a mental health group. I just know that it's something that really helps me. Essie wants everyone to know that Centro Donuts de Nuestra Comunidad stands for the Center of the Internal Gifts of our community. That name was chosen deliberately to reflect the approach we take in focusing on the strengths of our community. We take great pride at Centro Donuts in providing a safe space for our individuals and families to be vulnerable, yet focus on their internal gifts that will lead to recovery and resiliency. Essie was also the mystery Spanish-speaking caller from before that we hung up on an awful lot of the time, which kind of leads me to number three, providing those behavioral health services and real-time access to them. If we were to repeat that experiment again and have Essie call in, she's going to get connected to Jen over there on the right-hand side. Not only does Jen carry a clinical caseload, but she's also the voice of Centro Donuts. So if you're a Spanish speaker and you call in, you say, you know, I'm really struggling, I'm having a hard time, I'd just like to speak with someone, you're going to get connected to Jen. And during that same phone call, she's going to provide a behavioral health screening, you know, that initial phone screening that we all do. She worked with a family that said, Centro Donuts has been really great for my daughter. We've seen a lot of positive changes in her. She understands us more. Thank you very much for Centro Donuts. Still thinking about that important thing number three, providing behavioral health services, I'm going to talk about Nicole, the one in the middle there. That's her specialty. She has the highest caseload on the team, and as a little-known fact, she loves documentation. Who else loves documentation? Anne is the only one that loves documentation. That's all right. I didn't think I'd get a whole lot of hands on that one. You know, probably because you don't want the person next to you to know your secret that you really like documentation, right? That's okay. You can raise your hand. What happens in Breck stays in Breck. Anybody else? No? All right. It's just Anne today. All right. So Nicole likes documentation so much that she does her treatment plans in both English and Spanish. Why would that be? I think it's because it's the right thing to do. 86% of the consumers that we work with speak Spanish in the home. So if you give them a treatment plan written in English, you've already lost them. Anne worked with a young woman who started working at Central Donuts because she was so anxious she couldn't go to school. So after working with Nicole for a while, she went back to school. She said it's great to be back in school. I still get anxious, but I know I can handle it now. And I did ask all the members of the team to kind of give me some things for today. And so Nicole wanted to say that she really enjoys the opportunity that working at Central Donuts gives her, because every day she gets to work with a population that she's passionate about, and she loves to see that change happen in a family where they learn how to communicate with each other, and they start to appreciate and enjoy each other once again. So that takes me to thing number four, being an active part of your community, creating those community relationships, and that's what Peter, our program coordinator, excels at. He's our dreamer. He's the yes we can man. And Central Donuts is his community. So he reflects that in his 40 plus years of professional work, it's always been his dream to bring from a conceptual thought to a reality something that would provide meaningful services and programs for his community, and at the same time honoring their values and their language. Central Donuts does all that and more. This is, again, still Peter talking. He says that I can truly say that Central Donuts provides a very meaningful program for my community that has a very significant problem with mental health and substance use issues. He was reflecting on the team, and he said, you know, over the course of our 2 years in existence, we've learned that we have to be patient, we have to be consistent in how we approach it and the things that we do, and we have to go out to our community and not the other way around. We've learned that building it doesn't mean that they will come. And our success is as a team. It's not as an individual. Which leads me to, what do our outcomes look like? You might be wondering, you know, I always wonder, are we doing meaningful work? Are we making a difference? And I wholeheartedly believe that we are. If we look at our, we've provided almost 4,000 services to our community. 94% of which are provided in the community. It's 94% of our community are Hispanic. About two-thirds of the services that we provide are provided to clients that are never open to the center. So there are those community prevention and other classes that we do. So they never open for that, you know, episode of care kind of thing. We provide it in the community. Like Gary said, it doesn't feel like a mental health thing. The other third, we do open them up for an episode of care. And we'll provide services for anybody of any age, any diagnosis, any acuity level, and any payer mix. And more specifically on our outcome measures, if we think of the CCAR domains of overall symptom severity, overall level of functioning, overall recovery, and hope, our GAF scores, and our PCOM scores, which is an evidence-based practice, they all demonstrate, I always do this wrong because I can't say it together, they all demonstrate statistically significant positive change from admission to discharge. So I think we're making a difference. I got a thumbs up for not botching statistically significant. So I'd like to close with what's next for Central Donuts, and in a word, it's more. We're going to continue to be a positive influence and impact on our community. We're going to develop more community relationships and go to more community places to do what we do. We're going to hire more clinicians. We're going to provide interpreter services at our own prescriber appointments. And we're going to centralize and be more effective with how we use all of our bilingual resources throughout the center. So on behalf of Central Donuts and Nuestra Comunidad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan. Our next speaker today is E.J. Becker. She's an outreach therapist with the PATH program at Mental Health Services to Chronically Homeless in Aurora, at Aurora Mental Health Center. So, welcome.
So, imagine a cold and snowy day. Maybe it's Wednesday, or maybe for this scenario, we'll up the ante and say it's Friday. A person walks into your office, and as they begin to look around to get their bearings, you notice that they're wearing this dirty, dingy, once white but now brownish kind of colored jacket that covers like a blue hoodie, that covers a scarf that maybe used to belong to a child. You notice the muddy, snowy jeans that are covering the wet orange sweatpants that cover probably another pair of sweatpants. And you notice the gloves that don't match. You notice the black plastic bag starting to bulge as though it might pop full of, well, you're not really even sure what. And a sleeping bag that's soaking wet and slightly frozen on the floor from the cold. And as you begin to take in the image of the person that has just walked into your lobby, you begin to notice the smell. You know that smell? The alcohol mixed with body odor, mixed with wearing your clothes for too many days. Excuse me. And it registers in your head that this is a dirty, homeless human being that just walked into your lobby. And then your eye flicks to the clock on the wall or above the door or on your desk, and the sense of dread starts to sit in as this person starts to speak. They tell a long, tangential, kind of paranoid tale between slurred words and chattering teeth or possibly chattering gums, possibly about how they're homeless and maybe they want services and maybe they want housing, but you're not entirely sure what they're trying to say. And you feel the tension in your body as they ask you for help, and you think, what am I supposed to be able to do? And ultimately, you think it's Friday, and it's 4 o'clock, and I want to go home. You quickly cut them off, offer an appointment with their therapist or a case manager, and you grab a resource sheet from your desk or possibly a case manager, and you walk them out the door, saying, good luck, stay safe, keep warm. There's probably a twinge of guilt and sadness. You know this client. They never show up for their appointments. When they do, they're often making chaos in the lobby. They're yelling at people, threatening violence. They're probably high or drunk often. And the thought around them often is just like, I just don't think that they want treatment. Now, the story doesn't end there. That person leaves your office. They probably grab whatever change they can, make it to the liquor store or the drug dealer or whoever, because it just feels better to be in the cold when you've had one or two or three beverages. And as they wander the streets with the quickly dropping temperatures and the numbing limbs, and they stumble and they fall, and with any luck, they possibly stumble to a park that has one of those little blue emergency lights, or they stumble, or somebody happens to see them and calls 911, or possibly they happen to stumble into a cop. And they end up in the ER, they end up in our jails, and they end up in detoxes. And this is the pattern of a person experiencing chronic homelessness: unsuccessfully attempting to access services that are appropriate for treatment while successfully accessing high-cost and inappropriate systems for treatment. And when those folks access those inappropriate systems too much, they sometimes get punished. Jail time, limits in detoxes, limited access to ERs, not gaining access to really critical mental health emergency services. So that sounds really hopeless and sad, right? And it's sad to know that there are treatment systems out there that treat clients this way. And I'm here, my name's E.J. Becker, I'm an outreach therapist with the PATH program, and I'm here to talk to you about our program, PATH. PATH stands for Projects for the Assistance in Transition from Homelessness. PATH is a program through SAMHSA which targets providing mental health services to the hardest to reach folks. Those folks that don't show up for appointments are considered non-compliant, have resistance, as you have mentioned before, with treatment. And are typically considered like uncontainable. And what I noticed in my 10 years of working for homeless agencies that effectively engage homeless people is they have a very open way of interacting with participants and providing as many access points as possible for an individual to access services. When I was given an opportunity to start at the PATH program with Aurora Mental Health, I kept this in mind. And so what PATH's motto is, come as you are, as you want, as you need. We don't expect a whole lot from the folks, we just hope that they show up. What PATH does, instead of focusing on trying to contain our folks and mold them into a system that I work in, we focus on reaching out to our folks. It isn't their job to prove to me that they want treatment. It's my job to prove to them that treatment can work. It isn't their job to trust the system that I work in. It's my job to trust that they know what works and doesn't work for them in that system and advocate for them and hopefully make that system more accessible to them. What makes me better as a clinician with this model is we change the conversation from why aren't you being compliant to what can I do better for you? And we celebrate the successes that they choose to do and the choices that they choose to make. PATH recognizes engagement is a process and begins from before we do an intake to through the maintenance phase all the way through transition or termination of treatment. We're honest and transparent about what we can and cannot do for our folks. The truth is that there's a huge lack of housing stock for homeless people in the Denver metro area. Lots of people literally don't have places to go. PATH isn't pretending that that doesn't exist. We don't try to minimize, ignore, or placate the anguish our homeless people experience. But ironically, that transparency is how we build trust and is our foundation for achieving goals with our folks. Lastly, engagement means we provide as many access points for people to begin or to re-engage. We don't have time limits on sessions. We have flexible appointments, and by that we do a drop-in. You can access who you want to see when you want to see them, and we meet them where they are at. So that can be in our offices, in our lobby. We share a kitchen with our participants. It can be in the kitchen. It can be on the streets. It can be on our front porch. Our space is their space. Their space is our space, for the most part. So, for example, I worked with our second highest utilizer of 911 services in Aurora. He had been homeless for 20 years. He reported that what he appreciated most about PATH was that he never felt bad about failing at treatment. It took 4 months to get him into our drop-in, and it took 2 months after that to complete the intake. And when he showed up, we were just super excited he was there and did the things that he wanted to do. This was obviously not without goals. He and I both knew that the goal would be to narrow his behavior down from just dropping in whenever to actually scheduling his own appointments and eventually attending them on his own. After 20 years of failed attempts to do this on his own, PATH worked with him for 2 years and successfully transferred him to an intensive outpatient team. He's currently housed, actively engaged in treatment, and is compliant with both medical and mental health recommendations. So this is a high level of care, right? How do you manage that when you're working with homeless population? That's a fairly large population, actually. We do it by doing outreach, street outreach, and then also a drop-in center. So what we emphasize here is taking away all the barriers that have previously been made to accessing treatment and creating more access points. First, we have outreach. Outreach is how we begin to plant the seeds for those folks that struggle to walk in our doors. Outreach is where we begin to build relationships with folks that feel most hurt by their inability to access the system. So we do this by a little trick, a pair of socks and a handshake. We meet immediate needs, we meet physical needs, and we meet emotional needs. Outreach is not only used in the beginning of a relationship, but also while we work with folks to access services. Outreach helps us with those folks that tend not to prioritize the things that I might prioritize. So if I have Jeff and he has a doctor appointment at 10 o'clock, I've already set up that I know where I can find him if he actually wants to go, so that if he happens to forget or prioritize something else, I can go look for him and be like, hey, did you want to go? It's cool if you don't. And if he chooses not go, then I'm going to help him, or I might just cancel that appointment for him so that he doesn't burn that relationship with that provider. I work really hard for Jeff in this way initially, and unless he has some significant cognitive issues, the Jeffs of the world almost always start to make steps to do these things themselves. It's like magic. I can't really explain it. Actually, I think I can. There are three things that we've done here. The first thing that we've done is we've actively engaged him. We've reached out to him and showed him that we care. The second thing that we did is we honor and support his choices. It is okay that he doesn't want to go to his doctor appointment, and he gets to make that choice. And the third thing that we do is we've empowered him. We show him that we believe that he knows what is best for him and that he knows how to make the choices that are best for his life, no matter what those choices are. And that's a pretty incredible experience for people. So now we've planted some seeds and we've built some trust and we have there's still a pretty huge gap between having an outreach relationship on the streets and being able to sit in a room with a psychotherapist, right? So our answer to that was to do a drop-in model. So drop-in mental health, woohoo! How is that even possible? Weirdly enough, there are lots of social service organizations that target our same populations, and they focus on different issues and successfully have people show up, right? So how do they do it? Instead of creating a whole new model, I modeled our drop-in after the Harm Reduction Action Center in Denver, the Harm Reduction Therapy Center in California, and the PATH program through the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless in Denver. All of these have drop-in models, provide much-needed mental health services and support, have multiple ways of accessing services, and are really successful in getting people to show up. So PATH designed, so PATH drop-in is designed to take away barriers to engagement. Now, just because we get somebody to show up doesn't mean that they're all of a sudden able to make appointments and those kinds of things. So we don't require that. If you show up, we're going to see you. We really just encourage people to show up and accomplish whatever goals that they want to. So even though they've said that yesterday they want to do this, if today something else is more important, then that's what we're going to focus on. And as we're accomplishing goals, we're also working on clinical matters. What makes it hard to follow through? What makes it hard to make appointments? What kinds of supports do you need to be able to do these kinds of things? And in all of that, we're also talking about trauma history, family history of mental health issues, substance abuse, those kinds of things. Secondly, we allow people to engage who they want when they want to. So we have two outreach therapists and we have two peer staff. Even if I'm the primary therapist for that client, they can see any person in that center at that time. So if they wanted to see Blair instead of me for that day, then that is totally okay. Lastly, we create space for homeless folks to hang out where everyone is focused on similar goals, which was an unintended consequence and kind of an amazing thing, at least for me to watch. What is unique about what we see happening is people see each other being successful and getting access to services that they weren't able to access before. And some folks want that for themselves. Or they've started doing that, and they're like, hey, my friend Fred really should do that, right? And so we have this community that's actively engaged in each other and supporting and sharing resources and successes. It is not all on my shoulders to make sure that this happens. So now you're probably thinking that these are really, but still, this is very time-consuming. Like what I'm talking about, all this outreach, engaging, and all that kind of stuff, it's very time-consuming, especially with really chaotic and like multi-problem people. And you're right. It is. And so PATH can't do this kind of work alone. An agency cannot adequately serve people experiencing homelessness and mental illness in a silo. And so we partner with a ton of agencies. We have, each week, we have a community clinic with MCPN. We have a representative from the VA come in. We have an employment specialist that shows up. We have relationships with Hunger Free Colorado to help us with our more complicated cases with benefits. We partner with Aurora Warms the Night that does the cold weather beds in the winter, and the ACOT team that does the street outreach on the coldest nights of the year. We partner with local organizations that provide lunches and other basic needs. And we are building relationships with the police that interface with our folks most to decrease the number of tickets and increase referrals to us. We are continuing to build relationships with the teams within Aurora Mental Health to help them understand the issues associated with chronically homeless folks and how to serve them better. And we're working really hard to have better transfers from our PATH team to the Aurora Mental Health teams. We partner with other outreach teams throughout the Denver metro area. We partner with collaboratives within Aurora to know where we need to expand our efforts. And we are currently working with a collaboration that has this lofty goal of getting 100 chronically homeless folks housed by the end of this year. So, quick story to highlight this idea is we have the highest utilizing client in the city of Aurora started at PATH and is now housed for the first time in 15 years. He's currently linked to a program called the Triage Project, which is a collaborative between Aurora Mental Health and Arapaho House for those high utilizers of 911 services. He continues to come to PATH most days of the week, even though he is housed. He has a VASH voucher, which is a permanent supportive housing program through the VA, which gives him access to a housing case manager, substance use case manager, and then also medical team. He's connected to a handful of community agencies he interfaces with on a weekly basis. And without all these players involved, he probably would not be able to maintain his housing. And honestly, without all these players involved, I would not maintain my sanity. So I have definitely been a part of agencies where my job was to make sure that my clients were seen as the good kind of clients. And I found that I became a tool to a system to further hurt the people who I actually wanted to be successful. And there were times when I felt pretty hopeless about that. And when I was hired for this position, I wanted to create a program and a space that was not only open to the people that I serve, but also to the staff that work within it. And one of the favorite parts of my job, I think, is instead of trying to make our clients be the good kind of clients, I'm teaching clinicians and psychiatrists how the homeless clients are the good kind of clients to have. So imagine back to that destitute poor little client that walked into your lobby earlier. So this is a real story of a participant that came to PATH. We'll call him Joe. Joe comes to the door and knocks, and Blair, my coworker, lets him in. Both of us are kind of holding our breath. This is somebody who we've really struggled to, like, manage in our space because he can get very violent, and we don't want him to fail in this. And we're really invested in that. We are really invested in the idea that we are not going to kick him out. And both of us take a deep breath and greet him with smiles, and I state, "Oh, Joe, I'm so glad you're here. How are you doing?" And he responds with something like, "They came and kicked me out of my spot. I told them I don't have anywhere to go, but they are racist and hate me. EJ, do you have any toothpaste?" As he obsessively is putting hand sanitizer in his hair. I acknowledge that it's been a while since I've seen him, and it's been a while, so I say, "It's been a while since I've seen you. I've been thinking about you. I'm so glad that you came today. It's getting really cold out there. Sounds like you need a place to stay tonight, and no, I don't have any toothpaste today." I'm honest. Honesty is genuine and authentic, and he senses that, which makes our space safer for him, and in turn makes our space safer for us. I advocate for him. Aurora Worms and Night just finished giving out vouchers. I can ask Sarah and see if she has any left for you. And I go to Sarah and I ask. I say, "Hey, Sarah, do you happen to have any extra vouchers?" Because of our positive relationship we've built with this provider, she makes an exception for just this once. So I say, "Hey, Joe, Sarah's making an exception this one time. Next time you'll need to make sure you come in during the activation." We know that that's probably not going to happen, but now the boundary is set. So PATH staff assist in getting Joe to the hotel and checked in the lobby. Joe shows us how he understands the importance of his key and talks obsessively about which pocket is the safest one to keep it in. He invites us to his room to get settled. He is smiling now and excited, showing us things like the lamp in the room and talking about the importance of showering and personal hygiene. And we're saying things like, "Yes, that's a very nice lamp. Yes, that's where the shower is. Great, you found the toilet." He settles a little, and we are getting ready to leave the room. He stands still for the first time in this whole interaction and says to Blair, "Can I give you a hug?" And she says, "Yes." Thank you. Do you have any questions? No? I've been doing the PATH program for 3 years. Mm-hmm. It's kind of my baby. Okay.